Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
The use of force by Mattingly and Cosgrove was justified to protect themselves. This justification bars us from pursuing criminal charges in Miss Breonna Taylor's death.
Heartbreaking words today for those hoping criminal charges would be filed in the death of Breonna Taylor. Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron conducting what amounted to a criminal law class on why two officers were not charged and why the officer who was had nothing to do with Taylor's death. We're looking at all of the angles tonight in this very complex issue. Lines are open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Let us first start with former Prince George's County State's Attorney Glenn Ivey. Glenn, thanks for joining us. What happened in the case of fired Officer Brett Hankinson? What is first-degree wanton endangerment?
Well, the Attorney General announced that the grand jury had returned an indictment for one count and only against one officer, as you pointed out, and that was for wanton endangerment. And wanton endangerment, it's a lesser charge than manslaughter, certainly lesser than murder or reckless homicide. And it just means displayed an extreme indifference to the value of human life. And this is based on the same grounds that he was fired on shortly after this incident, that he blindly fired 10 rounds through a glass door that had the screen down, and the bullets went into a neighboring apartment and put three people there at risk. So that's the basis of the charges, the only charge that was brought by the grand jury today.
And actually, there were three counts of those because and that was mentioned in the first announcement by the grand jury, because they mentioned that the people in those apartments did not have the initials as Breonna Taylor. So actually, there were three separate charges of first degree wanton endangerment, but that had nothing whatsoever to do with the death of Breonna Taylor. What happened there?
Well, I think that's right. And my understanding is that it was a husband and wife and their child in the neighboring apartment that were put at risk by the shots that were fired by the door through the door blindly. But, you know, what happened, I think, with Cosgrove and Mattingly and the clip you played from the Attorney General, Daniel Cameron, was basically he said that Cosgrove and Mattingly, who were the first two officers that went into the apartment, were justified in returning fire, that essentially that they acted in self-defense. And so Mr. Walker, who was in the apartment with Breonna Taylor, hears people breaking in, gets his gun and fires a shot. The Attorney General is saying they acted appropriately and they were justified in returning fire at that time. So even though the fatal shot was fired by Cosgrove, at least according to the FBI, the local investigators said it was inconclusive, but the FBI said it was Cosgrove. So even though Cosgrove fired that shot, the Attorney General said the grand jury declined to return an indictment against Cosgrove or Mattingly.
And one of the other issues that came up was that the Attorney General said he does not believe that there will be any additional charges or indictments. And yet we can all agree, I think, even though there are different narratives, but the one thing that is clear, they were not at the right apartment. They were not in the right place. And that had to do with the warrant, the initial warrant that was issued for this incident. So why not hold the people who issued or sought the warrant responsible for the death of Breonna Taylor, even if the officers involved are not indicted?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, the officers got a search warrant for Ms. Taylor's apartment, and apparently they were, you know, it was based on this male that she had maybe dated or befriended but who didn't live there or hadn't been there in some large amount of time. And so the search warrant was based only on that. And I think, as we all know now, it was a no-knock warrant. There's a dispute about whether, you know, they knocked loud enough for people to hear inside. But it was a no-knock warrant that came in. Mr. Walker fired thinking that these were intruders, and that led to the danger, the deadly shooting of Ms. Taylor. So, I think it's the issue of whether there should be some accountability for the failure to, for the decision to go into a search this apartment in the way that they did at the time that they did, as strong as they did, I think is a real source of concern. So even though Cosgrove and Mattingly were not charged criminally, I would hope that there would be at least some administrative sanctions. I think they're still on the police department there. You know, the hope is, I would think, that at a minimum they'd be fired for this.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the Breonna Taylor case. If you have a comment or a question, you're certainly invited to join the conversation quickly. Let me go to BJ calling from Richmond, Virginia. BJ, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I kind of feel that either we're going to be cannon fodder for these police officers, or if we're not going to protect ourselves, who is going to protect us? And I don't think anyone will. I think it's up to us to go on offense and to kind of think of creative ways to do that.
What do you mean offense?
I think that's up for discussion.
Okay. BJ, thank you so much for your comment. I appreciate you listening. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Glenn, before I let you go, final thoughts about this decision today?
The obviously the community is deeply disappointed. The family is deeply disappointed. You know, I think the hope was that there would be not only some justice done here, but justice for all three of them. Clearly, Cosgrove and Mattingly are not going to be prosecuted. I know there's a federal investigation that's ongoing, so maybe that will be addressed there. But, essentially, now that the city's already settled on the civil side for $12 million, they won't be held accountable there. And clearly in the criminal case, they won't either. So you hope that that happens. And then the big key, though, is will Hankinson be convicted?
Yeah.
I think it's an open question. He's going to raise self-defense at his trial. We'll just see. We'll have to wait to see how it plays out. But
I think the whole nation
will be watching.
Real quick, something that was asked of me earlier today. Because of that settlement last week, the $12 million, is there any way, shape, or form that settlement could have had an influence on the decision by the grand jury today? That was certainly, asked by a layman. I'm not an attorney. You know the inner workings of this process. Any chance of that?
I don't know. Certainly it was, it made national news. So I wouldn't be shocked if grand jurors were aware of that. $12 million, at least for normal folks like me and you, is a lot of money, but
yeah,
not in exchange for a loved one. And
you
hope that that did not affect the decision about bringing criminal charges that was made by the grand jury.
Former Prince George's County State's Attorney Glenn Ivey, thank you so much for sharing with us. We appreciate your time.
I want to go to
Dr. Valethia Watkins. She is Director of Women's Studies, the Graduate Certificate Program, and Associate Professor of Africana Studies here at Howard University. Dr. Watkins.
Good evening.
Hi. How are you? This was really a rough one for those hoping to see more from the grand jury. Your reaction tonight?
The lack of accountability that we have been served certainly inflamed the passions of the community, as it should. We should never become numb to these types of cases. So although it was predictable, although it's business as usual, we have to channel our energy to make real structural changes, because it's not acceptable. And so we as a community, we value the humanity of this sister who has been lost, her talent. She was a EMS or EMT, a health worker in the middle of a pandemic. She should be treated as a hero, and the loss of her life is a tragic loss. And the fact that the message that has been sent over and over again that there's going to be no accountability certainly cannot be, we can't take that lying down.
Were you surprised at the way things turned out today?
As we say, in the context of the era that we're living in now, shocked but not surprised. Again, as I said, what we see over and over again is that the system has created a playing field that does not hold the people who have the power to use lethal force to the highest standard. And as they should be held to the highest standard when you are making life and death decisions. And so we have to change structurally what is in place. That is, the system is acting the way it was designed to act, and we have to change that design.
Let me go to Ron Hampton, former executive director of the National Black Police Association and co-convener of the D.C. Justice Collaborative. Ron, thanks for joining the conversation. You are a retired officer in the District of Columbia. You were on the street for many, many years. From your perspective, beyond the obvious, what went wrong in this drug raid?
Well, what went wrong was that the people wasn't the person who was put in charge in terms of the so-called attorney general, who was the special prosecutor, did not look at the issues thoroughly and comprehensively. Like, why were they there at first? The person that they were looking for, they could have picked this person up anytime because he was just somebody that was hanging on the streets selling drugs. Evidently, he didn't bother about looking at the whole picture in reference to what happened. Something is wrong with, and it's awful reckless for, if you're serving a warrant and then you just fire over 30 some shots into a place and then we can't talk about why you did it. We can't talk about the danger that's associated with that. It's just something wrong with it. That it's labeled excessive. That is an example of excessiveness. They did not have to do that.
Talk to me a little bit, Ron. I want to talk a little bit about police procedure, because as you just said, the person that they were looking for didn't live there, hadn't been there. First question, couldn't they have staked out that place to find out whether or not he had been there recently and picked him up that way? One question. The other question, also with it appears that they got some bad information about being there in the first place,
that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And yeah, they could have picked him up in another situation. It could have gone down very differently in another way. That is excessive, and it also proves that this no-knock stuff that they have and been using for years hasn't worked. We've had cases in Washington D.C. years ago. Caribbean, I forget what the name of it was, it had some name, because they were looking for people who were supposedly from Jamaica or from the Caribbean that was involved in gangs and drugs, and they were recklessly going into people's houses, serving no-knock warrants, and it ended up the city and the police department were sued because it's a bad practice, and it has always been a bad practice, because you're sort of operating at the whims and whims of the people you're dealing with, and you don't know what their motives or not are in relationship to what the information that you give. So there are just other ways to do this. And so I'm in that group that think that support rather that we need to get rid of this no-knock stuff. We need to get rid of it. And there's something wrong with the process that this brother is involved in that allowed him to do what he did, because there's no justice in what was said. And I just support her mother. I mean, I don't care about the $12 million. The $12 million does not replace Ms. Taylor's life. $12 million does not make her whole, does not make her family whole. And then this clown comes off with this three counts or something. and it doesn't mean anything. There's no justice in that.
Yeah, well, and to that, and you know, to that point, you know, Dr. Watkins, the, you know, Officer Brett Hankinson, the investigation found that none of the shots that he fired hit Breonna Taylor or her boyfriend, and that he had fired from, based on what we're hearing from the investigation, wildly and endangered the lives of people in, you know, in other apartments. And so it would seem that, you know, on one hand, now he's, you know, that may have been reckless. He's not been convicted of that, but that may have been reckless. But he was the one that everyone originally thought was responsible for the death of Breonna Taylor. And now it appears that that is not the case.
Right. And there's so much lack of transparency in the sense that, you know, dragging their feet and bringing this to the grand jury, that when you look at that incident report, that was virtually blank. And then when it says any injuries and it says none and you have a fatality, there is a deliberate, you know, will to not bring the truth forth to hold people accountable. And so, right. Yes, on the one hand, when they talk about they had reasonable fear, we need to challenge that. What about the reasonable fear of the victims, of the people right. who are the subject to this police action? And her boyfriend is the one that acted reasonably in the sense that he fired one warning shot, which was designed not to be fatal, and they did the exact opposite and endangered and killed an innocent person.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the Breonna Taylor case in Louisville, Kentucky. We are just about an hour or so away from a curfew that has been imposed in Louisville. And there are people from Louisville all the way to New York and other parts of the country that are protesting right now as a result of this. We're going to continue this conversation with analysis and commentary. I want to thank Ron Hampton for sharing with us. Dr. Watkins, you're going to stay on. We have so much more to talk about, so please stay with us. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM Channel 141 in just a few seconds. Coming up next, the original Quiet Storm on WHUR with John Mons. This conversation continues. Don't miss it. We'll be back in just a few. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. We are talking about the Breonna Taylor case in Louisville, Kentucky. Today, a grand jury returned indictments for one officer, three indictments for one officer, but those indictments have nothing to do with the death of Breonna Taylor. The other two officers involved in the drug raid gone wrong at her apartment on March 13th were not indicted. The Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron says it was self-defense. We are looking at all of the angles tonight in this very, very complex issue. On the line with us right now, we have Dr. Valethia Watkins with the Africana Studies Department at Howard University. Also joining this conversation now, Ashok Chandran, NAACP Legal Defense Fund Assistant Counsel. Thank you so much for joining us. Your thoughts about this case and where we are right now.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir.
I think this is a really important moment in demanding justice for Breonna Taylor, because justice for her life was never going to be limited to just the criminal prosecutions of the officers. And today we've seen that that's not going to happen, unfortunately. But that hasn't stopped hundreds and thousands of people from coming out into the streets to demand that something be done, to demand that changes be made. LMPD, the Louisville Police Department, has committed to some of those changes going forward. It's committed to end the use of no-knock warrants. The city council just passed that resolution recently. We'll see if that's actually going to be enforced and those restrictions are going to be respected. But people are demanding more. People are demanding a reimagining of what public safety is going to look like. And so part of what the Legal Defense Fund is doing is we are currently representing protesters in a civil action against the city of Louisville to make sure that police do not use extremely violent crowd control technologies against them, things like tear gas, flashbangs that we've seen too often used against people who are peaceful in the streets.
The Attorney General said that in the wake of what has happened, there is a task force that he is establishing to examine the way that warrants are executed, particularly as it relates to no-knock warrants, et cetera. Your thoughts about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was an interesting aspect of the Attorney General's announcement, because on the one hand, he found that the way that the warrant was executed was proper, but then on the other hand, recognized there's a need to engage with how this process is handled and what went wrong here that can be done better going forward. So depending on how rigorous the study of that task force will be and how meaningful the resolutions that it proposes are, we would welcome a reevaluation of how the warrant process goes and how officers are trained to approach situations that could become volatile. But that all depends on the rigor with which the Attorney General is going to commit to reevaluating the procedures.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Walter, calling from Southeast D.C. Walter, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good evening, everybody. I have a bone to pick with Daniel Cameron.
Okay.
Because I think he is biased towards the police. He shown that he is so much when we saw him on the Republican National Convention. And to me, Daniel Cameron thinks about his own political aspiration. Probably wants to be when Clarence Thomas leaves the Supreme Court, he wants to be on there. But I think Daniel Cameron needs to be investigated, because he did a poor job of investigating this. And I think it's just, when you talk about police reform, he doesn't want to convince those police officers. They should have been, number one, immunity from prosecution. But to just get one police officer, and you have all these police officers done this, and I think the one that was charged can only get 5 years. So to me, it starts with Daniel Cameron.
Hmm. What do you think about that, Dr. Watkins? We do know that the Attorney General Cameron had a key speaking role during the Republican National Convention. Do you think that was ill-advised, considering that he was in the midst of this politically charged investigation?
Yeah, I think it goes a step past ill-advised. I think it really showed his true allegiance was not necessarily to truth and justice, but as the caller said, to his potential political future. As the saying goes, a prosecutor with a grand jury can indict a ham sandwich. So the problem with the grand jury is the lack of transparency. Their proceedings are by law secret. And basically what he said at that press conference indicates that a lot of the facts that were in dispute that should have been taken before a fact finder, meaning a properly seated jury to be the fact finder. Like, for example, the one person who says they heard the police announce themselves when there are countless other witnesses said they heard no police announce themselves. And both Breonna's boyfriend said he didn't hear that. So those are facts that are in dispute. But yet the Daniel Cameron presented them as a undisputed fact, taking the word of the police officer. So him, along with Attorney General Barr, I think they
Attorney General Barr has indicated with his inflammatory rhetoric that this is politics. And certainly the president has indicated a great deal of lack of respect for the First Amendment and for peaceful protesters, classifying them and potentially talking about charging people with sedition, indicates that this is an election season and they're ready to use this as a political cudgel to advance their interests as opposed to the interests of justice.
Mr. Chandran, before I let you go, your final thoughts on this case and moving forward from the NAACP's perspective?
Yeah, so part of the concerns that both the caller raised and that we're discussing now about the propriety of the investigation and the case that Attorney General Cameron actually put on to the grand jury is why LDF is calling so strongly for complete transparency with respect to the grand jury proceedings. We want the grand jury minutes. We want, to the maximum extent possible, to see how Attorney General Cameron and his office chose to present this information to the grand jury. Because, as my co-panelist mentioned, securing an indictment is often the lowest legal bar in terms of a criminal action. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is the standard for holding someone, finding someone guilty. But to indict someone, you just need to establish that there's a likely probability that they committed a crime. So we want to know exactly how the grand jury came to these decisions. What information did they see? How did prosecutors frame this information? What weren't they told that they should have been told? What were they told that maybe they didn't need to be told? All of that information is critically important in deciding the propriety of the investigation and the presentment.
That's amazing. I want to thank you so much for providing your perspective, Ashok Chandran, NAACP. Legal Defense Fund Assistant Counsel, I appreciate your time. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You know, one of the things, Dr. Watkins, that during the course of the day, just kind of tossing around, you know, this issue, and there's a lot that we know. But there's so many things that we don't know, and a lot of people are putting themselves in the position of, you know, Breonna Taylor. You know, this happened in the early morning hours of March 13th. This was not in the middle of the day. It was in the middle of the night. And if, you know, we are talking about an apartment, but we don't know what her boyfriend heard. He said he didn't hear the police announce. He just heard somebody trying to get into the apartment. And for a lot of people, there's the rub. Because if you, assuming, and we don't know, but assuming that he and Breonna Taylor were asleep in the middle of the night, and then somebody, you know, bangs on your door and announcing that they're the police, you know, how much clarity are you going to have before you finally wake up and figure out what the heck is going on? And I think that's one of the things that is so problematic.
Absolutely. I think that weighs on all of us. Aside from just caring about her humanity, it's the fact that we're all endangered by this process. And what that meant was that, you know, her last minutes, not even knowing what hit her, but in fear that they're being invaded by, it's a home invasion and trying to get a grip of what's going on. Again, saying that we need to get more information that we haven't gotten, because this has been, in many respects, a cover-up. It has been designed to not give us a clear picture of what went down. I would say, is the gender dimension to this whole process, that, again, it just shows that for a black woman, for a black man, gender provides absolutely no protection. So, you know, people think about women being held to a different standard because they're women, but in reality, they're treated just as bad or just as disregarded as black men in this society. So no black person in this community has protection against the state violence that is being meted out by this system as it's presently constructed.
And we shouldn't have to have, we need to talk about, too, the role of video. You know, it seemed like the only way we halfway get an opportunity to hold some accountable is if we have a video. But we cannot make that such a high standard that we have to have a video every single time to demonstrate wrongdoing. And so there's so much from top to bottom, the elimination of qualified immunity, the change of the no-knock process, the fact that they didn't wear body cameras, the fact, what is the message that has been sent? And you saw the other officer, Battenly, wrote a very inflammatory statement yesterday to his fellow officers. So he clearly is unrepentant, has no remorse, attacked the protesters, attacked Breonna, and attacked the FBI for all things. So the message that he's gotten is that this was okay and he will do it again.
Let me go to Alvin Herring. He is the executive director of the Faith in Action Committee. Alvin, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Thank you, dear brother, and thank you also to the other guests on the show tonight. We're gathered here for a very solemn cause and for a moment of real tragedy, not only for Black folks in this country, but for all those who love justice and are seeking the truth.
I will tell you, in the last hour or so, you know, as I'm looking at the TV monitors, and you can see that there is a continued bubbling up of outrage, and the city of Louisville was prepared for, you know, some of the, you know, an emotional response. The governor was prepared for an emotional response. There were people who were standing out and standing outside in Kentucky, in Louisville, and in Jefferson County, waiting for this. Talk to me about what that means on the ground emotionally for that. For that community over the past 6 months and the past 6 hours.
Yeah, I think I think your question is a really thoughtful one, because in moments like this, where we are appropriately focused on the pain and tragedy of those who are closest to the case and closest to the situation, and we pray mercy for Breonna Taylor's dear family and close friends, we must also remember that as they've gone through this, so has a whole community. Louisville, Kentucky is my hometown. I was born and raised in Louisville and born and raised in the West End. The West End is the most significantly Black part of the city, and in every way, geographically, economically, socially, culturally, and before the law, cut off from the rest of the city. I indict the city of Louisville tonight as one of the most racist cities in this country. I indict its leadership for failing once again to protect and uphold justice for the sake of Black folks. I indict the state of Kentucky for having an attorney general who only recently even spoke to the dear family of the deceased Breonna Taylor, and who, although eloquent in his statement today, seemed really clear to avoid being able to share what any other human being would share, and that is a deep sense of personal loss and sorrow and grief. Louisville tonight is a city that is racked with grief. It is mourning. It is a city that is that has been hurt. It's young people. It's old people. It's Black population. And for that matter, for those precious few whites who care enough about justice to lean their heart in the direction of Breonna Taylor and her family, they're all really mortally wounded tonight. This is not the first of these experiences for Louisville. Several years ago, when I was a minister there in Louisville, there was a young brother whose life was lost. His brother's name was Newby. And he was shot in the back by a police officer. We marched for 40 days and 40 nights under the direction of Reverend Coleman, who's deceased, God bless his soul. And those of us who were ministers gathered with those who were organizers and everyday people from the streets. And we were able to push for the first time in Kentucky history, I believe, that a police officer was indicted for the shooting and murder of a Black citizen. We got him indicted. You know, they say that you can indict a ham sandwich, but we managed to get him indicted against tremendous odds. He was put on trial. And for the most part, we understand there was either an all-white or mostly white jury that was seated, in a city that's 33% black. And you know the rest of the story. He was exonerated, went on to be hired by another police department. This is not new for the people of Louisville, not new for that community. I pray for them tonight. They're deeply saddened. Their hearts are wounded. And once again, they must feel like, will there ever be relief? Will we ever find justice?
Could you give me some context? And I'm so glad that you shared a little bit of your own personal history, which allows me to ask this question about the West End, where Breonna Taylor lived, and some of the changes that were going on prior to this incident. We've seen so many reports about urban renewal, gentrification, whatever you want to call it, and that this was less about finding Breonna Taylor's ex-boyfriend and more about sweeping through that community in preparation for the changes that were being worked on.
You know, I tell you, that was one of the most troubling aspects of this case, and there have been so many troubling aspects. Let me tell you about the West End of Louisville that I was raised in, and that anybody who's been raised in the West End for the last 30 or 40 years would probably say the same. This community is the heart and soul of Louisville, Kentucky. These people, my dear brothers and sisters, created what I call a black cocoon for me and so many others. I was loved. I was seen. I was appreciated. I was known. I was cared for. The folks who live in the West End and the entire kind of cultural reality of the West End is geared toward community. It's geared toward the best of what black people bring into the world, frankly, what we bring into the universe. That's deep regard for family, love for our ancestors and our elders, particular joy in raising our children. One of the most beautiful vistas in the West End is Shawnee Park. And, you know, there's not a person who ever lived in the West End who doesn't have fond memories about being in that park and being gathered with other black folk for the Turkey Bowl or the Dust Bowl or all these other social and cultural events that took place in that park. But what we also have to kind of focus on is the way in which the rest of the city and those in power, the moneyed and powerful elites, have consistently forever neglected the needs of the West End, consistently over-policed the West End. It is one of the areas of the country where there are the fewest number of grocery store outlets. Public transportation is so woefully lacking. There are roads that aren't cared for. I lived in a street in the West End, and in my 40 years of living there, the street was never paved once. When I lived in another part of the community, our streets were paved on a regular basis. It's just an inordinate amount of oppression. And you talk about marginalization. That's what many of us who know the West End, that's what we felt every day. Though we were loved among ourselves, the rest of the community marginalized and separated itself from the West End. Anyone who knows Louisville will tell you about the 9th Street divide. Past 9th Street, the city of Louisville operates as though it has no obligation to those residents from 9th Street down to 45th Street to the river, because those, dear brothers and sisters, are black.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Watkins, when you look at the totality of the events that have happened today, and as we are very, very close to a curfew, now, what would be your message to those people who are out there protesting? I must admit that as we have seen in just about any city this year, when the clock strikes whatever time it happens to be, 9 p.m., 7 p.m., and the police move in and the protesters are still there, that things begin to get very dicey.
Yeah, I have to say, first of all, I appreciate the heart and the courage and the commitment of people to take a risk to stand up for justice and to put their lives on the line, to do the right thing, to say we're not
going to decidedly accept this abuse and this criminality against our community. We value each other. So I applaud their courage, their heart, and I say that we have to fight on many fronts. That part of the cynical game that's going on is that their deliberate provocations that are in terms of overreaction by the police to innocent protesters who want to express their just and legitimate dissent from this abuse, that, you know, that there are forces that want to use this moment for their political advancement. So I say we need to have heart, that we can't be cynical, that we have to really, with the upcoming election, we have to vote as if our lives depend on it, because we have to make a change on all levels. It's not just the presidential level. We can vote out Daniel Cameron and put in prosecutors that are going to be accountable to the community. So this is a time for all hands on deck, and we all have to get involved in our own way, and we have to fight on many, many fronts. It's not just going to be marching. It's not just going to be voting, but we have to change structurally. We have to get people in place that can begin to dismantle the systemic rules that are in place that keep producing these days of infamy over and over again. So I applaud their courage. They're in a long line or a long tradition of freedom fighters, and that they are really out there, young warriors, trying to make a change. We got to support them on every level, but we also have to fight on other fronts too. So vote, vote, vote.
The thing also that I'm really, you know, wondering about is, you know, Alvin, what do you believe this day has done to Louisville, considering the history? Is this a watershed moment for hopelessness or being hopeful?
Yeah, you know, as a clergy person, I get asked all the time about hope. And these days, what I've been saying is that, you know, I don't place much stock in hope. I place my stock in faith. And my faith tells me that, just as our dear sister said, though folks may be mourning now, weeping will endure for a night and maybe many nights, yet we rise. And I do believe, as has been the case in so many instances in Louisville, that folks from the black community and those well-meaning whites and others who still believe in justice and still believe it can be obtained, who still believe in democracy, still believe that they have a role to play in it, I believe that they will rise soon and do as our dear sister said. They'll vote, they'll protest, they'll march, they'll communicate, they'll love, they'll preach, they'll sing. And they will continue this long journey towards justice. 1789, that's when the 15th Amendment was passed. 1789, ensuring in that instance that black men could join white men in voting. And then in 1965, we had to come back again and say, hold on, let's preserve the right to vote. Before that, we had to ensure that women had the right to vote. Then we had to come back in 1992 and say, hold on once again, let's preserve the right to vote for black folk and not put any impediments in front of them. And here we are in 2020, still fighting that battle. But here's the powerful reality here. We are still fighting. And anyone who doesn't believe that this isn't a fight, anyone who doesn't believe that this may take more than a minute, as young folks say, then you're sorely mistaken. But anyone who doesn't believe that we won't ultimately overcome, you're betting in the wrong direction. I am more determined now, and I think our dear brothers and sisters will rise and will be more determined than ever to get justice for Breonna Taylor. And here's what justice looks like. Justice looks like having the capacity to control the police, and where it is important and necessary to control them, to control them to the extent that we no longer fund them in the way that they are funded, or that we defund them altogether, and that we put in place instruments of public safety in our communities that love black people and love people and understand that the first and foremost responsibility is to protect and serve. We don't have that now. And as Mattingly's sick email demonstrated, that us against them mentality that happens to be so true and so robust in so many police departments across the country, that has sickened the hearts of men and women who wear those badges, that we have to challenge and we have to contest. And ultimately, we have to eradicate if there's ever going to be real safety and justice in this country. So is it a watershed moment? I believe it can be. Was George Floyd a watershed moment? I believe it was. Certainly, these are certainly moments if we make them. And the way to make them be moments that are watershed, the way to make them be inflection points, is to rise in our own power, speak in our own voice, and take into our own hands our own authority to move to create a life for ourselves that's manufactured out of our dreams and hopes and aspirations, mm-hmm. and not someone else's.
Dr. Watkins, I'll let you have the last word here. What, in your mind, does justice look like in this case?
Well, I would say that, calling on the ancestors like Fannie Lou Hamer, when people say they're sick and tired of being sick and tired, as in her words, and they sometimes feel like they can't go on, these moments should make us feel closer to our ancestors and what they went through. And we stand on their shoulders, and they said that they looked into the eyes of the children, and that gave them the strength to fight on for the next generation. So justice is going to be the justice we take into our own hands with our actions. Even if we don't get it from the system, our actions in fighting back say we value ourselves, that we will rise in our power, as the minister said, and that we are going to put forth our own human dignity and humanity. And so we're going to be witnesses to this injustice, but we're going to reimagine and call into existence the system that we deserve, that our ancestors fought for to bring us here, and now we got to do it for those who are coming behind us.
I think that's a good place to end this conversation, this important conversation for this evening, but I'm sure that we are going to have many, many more moving forward. That curfew, just about an hour away now in Louisville, Kentucky. Protesters on the streets of Louisville and in cities all across this nation. We will continue to keep an eye on this. Dr. Valethia Watkins, as well as Alvin Herring, thank you so much for joining us. I want to thank all of our guests who participated in this important conversation. That is the Daily Drum for this Wednesday, September 23rd. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for Unheard with Wes Hall. Good night.